ideal, whatever that means.
Okay, I figured out how I figured the yes becomes more ideal. And the way I did was comparing the kinetic energy of the electrons to the typical Coulomb energy, which basically said the motion of the electrons becomes more relevant compared to the electrical attractions. It's the electrostatic attractions which break down the ideal gas law in most cases.
Right. We were called an ideal gas law.
Yeah.
Can you write that?
Okay.
Yes. So.
Oh, so when this is satisfied, or when this is approximately correct.
Yeah, and so if you have a highly charged plasma, would that be willing to, do you think that would be accurate? Like whenever the electrical charges are.
No, that's when we have to add in the fudge factors.
So that, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
my fudge factors.
I forget in the exact equation, but I'm gonna find little a and little b and that. One of them depends on the physical size of the particles, the other on the electrical attraction between them.
So part BS in a spherically symmetrical case, and then given this stuff, where it's in equilibrium, so the geometry pressure is bouncing in the gravity.
You can draw that.
So we just have some star, some core. At each point, there's gravity, there's an outward pressure force, I guess. So, force per unit.
So you're already halfway to solving the problem.
Well, I didn't have time. And then you show that the density satisfies the equation in each way. So I can write that. No, wait. I'm just going to write it.
That's all right. I just wanted y'all to start thinking in advance about what you would do if you had done this problem, so that whenever it's presented in a few minutes, it won't just be electron. Artsy?
Yeah, I'm just reading.
Oh, sorry. Unless you're waiting for me.
So we're supposed to consider the density equation for the non-relativistic case. And using a suitable transformation, show that it reduces.
What kind of transformation?
Oh, there it is. So I'm not sure. It says with a suitable transformation variables.
Suitable.
Oh, sorry. I'm just a little bit annoyed right now. So
that's fine. I can tell it's fine. That's fine. I'm in trouble.
And then you're supposed to numerically integrate the DE you get, the reduced DE, and then show that there's a certain relationship between N, R, and the masses of the proton and electron, and Z, which is, I'm not sure what that is.
Certain relationship between
MR and then the mass of the electron and the mass of the proton. And then set choose what element number? Not sure. That doesn't make sense.
Z is atomic number?
The number of protons.
It is atomic number. And then area. And then you do the relativist case in a similar type of you make transformations and then you numerically create a different relationship.
Right. Very good.
Yeah. I can look at the next time because I can.
So you can do that instead of the counter control?
Because I didn't numerically, I guess, keep my distance sort of thing what I do the next time. I have to think of it.
Okay.
You forgotten what you've done? But
wait.
A little bit, yeah.
Hold on.
But if anybody else wants to do
it.
All right, well, either we can talk, or Robert can either talk you through it, or Brian, you can do it.
I think
let's
go on to set four. And if we get through it, then we have to get done with the problems that
we have. Can we do it a bit later when we have done it? When we have done the second assignment?
Well, it's been over a week now.
It's 2 weeks.
Just.
I was planning on doing it later today.
Well,
bad timing.
Yeah, well, I don't know. What do you think, man?
Wow, I think doing it is better than never doing it. I think it's like this. Everything. I don't know what it can be. If Brian has done it, you're the only one who has done it.
I don't care.
Do you want to let me this one take away their opportunity to do
that? That's that. Okay. So we can do it another week.
Yeah, and in the future, the idea is that you should try to progress through the problem sets in numeric order.
So it was just the second one because it had numerical things, and I sent you an email.
But there's many parts that are left.
Yeah,
it was the whole second problem plus the numerical bits that are left out actually. So if you had everything else but the numerical bits,
it's mostly not numerical.
What?
It's mostly not numerical.
Yeah, it's 95% numerical bits are the kind that require none of the subtlety of the first of 2.10. They're really just type it into mathematic method. In just change integrate to capital M integrate, type in the formula, and we'll do it.
But it didn't work. We worked on it with Mina very much, but
the second part?
It didn't work.
Yeah, remember what I showed you guys last week? You need to apply some tricks and parameters.
No. For the second problem, it should be.
The second problem, yeah.
Doesn't even have that problem.
Did it have that problem?
No.
Yeah. The first problem, The first problem was very tricky. Mm-hmm. I expected that one to be hard. The second problem was supposed to be.
Just an integration, right?
Yeah. It's just, it was a bit deceptive because it looked like it was going to be hard again, but this one is actually simple.
Okay, I guess we should do problem four then. Okay, good. So I trust then that since you forgot the problem two, you must have made a lot of progress with problem set four.
I do number four. I do number four.
You do number four. Okay. Well, let's see how far we can get. So the number one. Anybody has done number one? There's a big box there.
Oh, okay.
There are small chunks that scattered around.
So we should find an approximate formula for viscosity of a gas as a function of molecular cross section and other properties. So we start by writing the distribution function. As Laxerian distribution function. Plus another function g. This is a variation of the Maxwellian distribution function. We assume g not to be very big. So if we write this Boltzmann equation,
by the way, how many of you don't have a copy of Padmanabhan's book?
I mean, borrowing.
You're borrowing from my friend. Yeah.
I'm borrowing from my supervisor.
Okay.
I bought it.
You bought it? And there's a copy there, I guess, found with that one?
I copied it in Iran because.
Okay. You don't have to confess to the crime. Okay. So I guess everybody has it now. And you don't need a copy, right?
Yeah, just an example in the library.
At the library. How many copies are at the library?
I'm taking it from UW.
Are you at the You have to return it, or?
Yeah, it's actually what we do, because people keep requesting it.
Okay.
It's a bit of a PI library. Right?
Yeah, on reference.
But I have an extra copy. I don't know what I need most. You should decide among yourselves.
There should be a competition for who does the best problem set.
That's right. Yeah.
So I guess the person who needs it the most is the one who does the worst problem.
It's hard to decide, isn't it?
The rich get rich.
This is also an equation. I won't go through the derivation of this because we went through it the session we were working on it, working on mock through it, yeah. And I just substitute the distribution function for f. And I'm just writing the right hand side. And in computing this, we have just neglected the terms which are quadratic in G, because we are assuming G is not, it's small.
What happened to your F shot term? The background?
What happened to which term?
The F naught, the Maxwellian
distribution. You mean F naught? So that gives zero if you plug it into PI, right?
Can you say, this is zero?
No, from the top line, which is one.
Okay.
That's so what I'm
what's the question?
Just asking what happened to that.
To this? Well, they are the same. This is
the same. No.
Oh. I should have written it this way.
Was that your question? No.
Okay. So, so I want to approximate, and I do much approximation in this. I will just look at the last term in this equation to have a rough estimate of what this is. And another approximation here, this integral on sigma would give the total cross-section, it's an approximation, the integral with the distribution function will give the number density, and we'll have the number density multiplied by the relative velocity, the average relative velocity. So, as we see, this is just 1 over the cross section time. So, what we can do is to write again the Boltzmann equation.
So what do you mean by cross-section time? Time between collisions.
I'm using that terms, yeah.
Okay.
Time between collisions. Third approximation here, we just put the Maxwellian distribution here. Maxwellian distribution is a function of t, n, and velocity. So computing these derivatives, I write one of them. Can I use this board?
Absolutely. You can use any board you want. You can write directly on the wall, in fact. And we're very generous.
So by writing the derivatives this way, with n, temperature, and velocity, we can compute g here by solving this equation. And, well, just minus f.
Velocities don't have explicit dependence on time. Right? Because, I mean, at every point, you have the whole phase space of velocities, at every point in space. So I'm not sure what that term means. Right? It's not, vi is not a single number at every point in the space. It's,
It's can assume two beams of particles colliding together, can't we? So it can be the velocity of one of them.
Okay, so that's a problem. So in this the left hand side of the Boltzmann equation, so it's in the phase space. So the partial derivative is with respect to time, space, and velocity, and for each of them you have to keep the other two fixed. So partial by partial t means velocity is fixed and position is fixed. So that's why that term doesn't make any sense. Partial vi by partial t, that shouldn't be there because you are by definition keeping velocity fixed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think.
It's the force. It's really, it's like if there's an exterior gradient.
Yes, there could be, the force is the third term on the left-hand side of Boltzmann equation, but...
I presume that's what you think.
Yes, but the first term in the Boltzmann equation, you're keeping velocity fixed by definition. That's why...
I agree.
I'm
saying that's probably
what
you're probably thinking of the exterior
force.
Rate of change of v to t.
Yes.
Right. So there could be an acceleration or a
general
shifting.
Well, I think I'm actually putting the force zero.
Right. So this
should be zero here.
I was trying to say. it is in fact not supposed to be, I'm just saying.
Okay.
Suggesting that maybe that's true.
No, it was a mistake.
Sorry, I made it worse.
Well, when I reached this stage, I was just stuck. I couldn't do all the computations. So I looked at Kujuri's book, Fresh Physics, and it has solved this equation. And G is by the way, U is
you have two different U's here.
Yes, this is big U, capital U.
Okay.
I remember this thing, something VI XJ plus. Some constant here. So now what we want is the Pij tensor to find the Pi ij tensor, which gives us the viscosity.
So Sam, I'm a bit confused. We have U's and V's and programs and. So what? So G is just a function of X, U, and T. Okay, VI is the bulk velocity. VI is the mean velocity of the Maxwellian distribution, right?
VI?
Yes. Okay, so then what I said before was wrong. About that, the latter should be there. So I was confusing it with you, so apologies. Yes, so that could be a function of, yes.
So I'm confused too, you should explain it to me.
Okay, so there are two velocities here. One is the phase space coordinate. So at every point, there could be different particles of different velocities. So you have a whole phase space of distribution. At every point, it can have any value of u. But then the Maxwellian approximation, the Maxwellian approximate Maxwellian distribution means that there is approximately a temperature, a density, and a mean velocity that quantify the whole distribution at every point in the space. So the whole phase space distribution, well, the whole velocity distribution is quantified by those three numbers. And those three numbers are a function of a space and time. But not lost u anymore. So they quantify the distribution in the velocity in the space. So they could depend at a fixed space, they could depend on time basically, or they could depend at a fixed time, they could depend on space. So they're just a function of space and time. Mm-hmm. So that does make sense there. Mm-hmm. And those partial derivatives, you're fixing x and the partial derivative with respect to time. So, but I guess you haven't skipped the stages in between. So VI is again there is the mean velocity at every point. So these VI are just a function of X and V. No, that they are functions in real space and time, not in the phase space. So G is the function of the phase space, though. G does depend on both X and U. And that's how U does appear there, I think, right? A small U does appear through the big U. Okay,
Yes.
So G is proportional to the gradient of velocity and gradient of temperature, basically. The gradient of fluid velocity and gradient of temperature. Perfect. Okay, and that's a step in between, I guess. So we're just going to accept that for now.
Okay. But I have a question. When you partial V, partial T, what kind of quantity do you fix?
So that's X.
X
position, a spatial position. That's what you fix.
But I do not think so. You consider the article go along one line.
So these aren't for particles. That's not for particles. So these three parameters, T, or there are two parameters and one vector. So I guess there are five parameters here. So they are just, they're average, they describe the average properties of particles at every point in the space. At every point in the space, there's a temperature, there's a density, and there's a mean velocity. And they could change with time, but they're just function of position because you're averaging over all the particles at that point.
So it's a new space.
It's a
in new space. It isn't in phase space.
That's right. But this is new space, or
because phase space mm-hmm. is 6n dimensional, and new space is just 6 dimensional.
No, I don't know what you mean by the neighbor space.
This describes the whole system by a point, just one point in gamma space, and this with n points in mu space.
Okay, if that's what you call me. What I meant by phase space was the six dimensional space.
Okay.
So F are functions in your mu space, or phase space, I suppose. So the F is the function of X and U. So that's three parameterization of six dimensional space. T, N, and that mean velocity, they are functions of just X. So they are in three dimensions, three dimensional. Okay, perfect.
So
you're going to get the viscosity from me?
Yes.
That does give you viscosity.
You won't see that.
I think you can arrange that, so you have to do it.
Yeah.
Sorry, you have to do this next week. It's okay.
And this pi and j will give the viscosity. So, and the definition of pij is n.
How do you know that?
That's the definition of pij. But from here,
no, that's
we reach here. That's the result of this.
So was that shown in one of our previous problems? So that's the definition. But this is defined in one of the problems that we solved in the previous weeks, wasn't it? Or maybe Mark showed this.
I don't think we have shown this, but...
this is a stress tensor, right?
Yes.
Okay. So this was derived, I think, at like the beginning of section 3. There is... It's called TIJ. So it's question 3.7.
Okay.
But, yeah, okay, so that's just that.
Mm-hmm. And this, the distribution, if it just Maxwellian, we'll just have this term. And you
know, the velocity. I did direct.
Sorry?
I did direct.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, somebody, y'all must have really, either I did a really bad job
or
everyone was asleep.
So, what IIJB is. So now I need help. can someone tell me why this is traceless? This tensor.
Why is it traceless? Is it traceless? So why should it be traceless?
No, it is traceless, but it will have some implication afterwards. It will give us the, well, as this is traceless, we would be able to define pi as this tensor minus its trace. Okay, which would be the divergence of the velocity. And then that would give us the viscosity.
Yeah, it looks to me like the reason might possibly be in how when we change from G to F, we were subtracting off the trace of U, which kind of roughly would carry over to pi, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Might be able to show that with a bit more work.
In terms of K and L, it's this integral is traceless, but not in terms of I and J.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if that's the case.
Oh, way up there, when we defined P, we defined pi as being traceless because we're splitting up P into two parts. One is just a diagonal matrix of the delta function, and another, and then a traceless part.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the definition. So I think the first term is just the Maxwellian part.
So pi is not necessarily traceless.
Yeah, pi. That
from that definition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, pi. So that's right. So that definition of pi just says there's a Maxwellian part and there's a non-Maxwellian part. So pi is a non-Maxwellian part. P is. Is that right?
Yes, pi is the non-Maxwellian part. The viscous part.
Yeah, so that just by itself doesn't say it's necessarily traceless. Okay, so just if you take the trace, it just gives you U squared times that expression there. But what is this integral? So that it has four indices.
It's the sum over k and l.
Ah, it's interesting. Yeah, okay. So that's right. It's sum over k and l, but that's outside the integral. So just let's take the trace of this. Just write down the expression for the trace. It's U squared, yeah. Okay, so this integral, it has two indices left. You already summed over i's, right? So the integral has only two indices. What could it be proportional to after you take the integral? In terms of its tensorial structure or matrix structure, you don't have anything left after you integrate over U. You don't have any vector left. You see what I'm saying? So F naught is a Gaussian in U.
Yes.
Right. So you're integrating over this Gaussian.
Yes.
So after you're doing that, there is no U left after integrating.
Yes.
There is no U left. So what could this integral be proportional to? It has two indices. So this is similar to what we discussed just the last week. So if you take an integral of a tensor with two indices.
It was delta. It's
the same here. I guess that's the only one answer to this. But it's not always delta if there is some vector appearing in F, for example, or there's something, a tensor or something is appearing in F, then this could be proportional to other things. Mm-hmm. But since F is completely symmetric, there is no vector or tensor or anything appearing in F. It's just a scalar. then this integral could be for just proportional to delta KL, right?
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that have a trace?
Okay, but so that then let's make that assumption that it's delta KL times some number, and then find that number. Okay, just write that down. That integral is
number?
Times a number, yes. Okay, so how did we find that number? Now that we've decided this is, should be the structure. Any ideas? No? Okay, so we did the exact thing, the same thing that last week as well. So you just take the trace of both sides, right? So that, see what I'm saying?
Yes, the trace of.
No, just. So this is equal to this, right? This is, we established, forget about this part. We established that this should be proportional to delta KL times a number, right? Because that's the only tensor that this could be proportional to, the only matrix that is proportional. We don't have any other vector. After integrating you out, we don't have any other vector or matrix or anything yet. So this could be just proportional to delta on some number. To find out what this number is, you can just take a trace of both of these. This is, the trace of this is going to be GB. Right? Trace of this is zero. Right? Because this is u squared minus trace of delta is 3 minus times 1 third is 1. This is u squared minus u squared is 0. So it says that g should be 0. Do you see that?
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yes. But I still don't understand why this integral should be a number complicated by delta.
Can I suggest another way to think about it? Maybe it's less. Just think about breaking those all down into components. You could write out a whole long series of terms, right? Okay, so I can take any number, k can take any number, mm-hmm. Rho can take any number, right? And so whenever k and I are different, right? Then that'll be so. Maybe actually, could you push the board up and write, I just put up just like the I.
So I just write a couple.
Just the first. Just the two for just the U's. U sub I.
So U1 2. Sideways.
Yeah. No. Not plus. It's times, right? This is important. So it's the U1 squared times UK times U off row, right?
All right, components of this.
Just those two. Just UK, U row. Just like that at first. You can stop.
Right.
You can stop now. Okay, so the important thing is, so U1, so the first mixed term is U1 times U2, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, so could you write that, just that term out? Like,
this term?
No, the U1 squared times U1 times U2.
And U1 times U2.
So that's U1 to the third, right? So if you integrate that over U1, is it odd or even?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be odd, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anytime that you have an odd number, if you integrate over an odd number, will be zero, right?
Okay.
can you see that all of the terms are either going to be odd,
mm-hmm.
or even? So which are, can you, you've written, have you written, the point is you've already written all of the even terms, which are U1 squared plus U2 squared plus U3 squared.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the even terms, all of the ones that are going to make odd combinations, or all the cross terms, all of those just get integrated to zero. And that's why that all ends up being proportional to delta. And so really, once you've integrated uk times u rho minus 1/3 delta k rho u squared, that so the first part becomes exactly 1/3 delta k rho, because all of those integrals are exactly the same. Does that make sense? Okay. So I think that's a component proof of what Nia Yesh said.
The idea is that Gaussian function play a critical role in this in order to obtain your conclusion.
Right. Well, yeah, you had to know that the integral of the over an odd combination is zero.
But it doesn't need to be Gaussian. It could be anything symmetric.
Yeah. All it has to do is be symmetric about zero.
At the most, a function of u1 squared plus u2 plus u.
Doesn't have to be. Just anything that's odd. Anything that's even. So an integral over an odd number, over. I can't. The point is that if you have an odd power, that number raised to an odd power, and then you integrate over a symmetric integration, that's always.
But if it's not a function of u1 squared plus, then the integral for u1 are not equal to u2 because the interval will be different. Although this interval is a diagonal.
Yeah.
There is something there.
But the general point is that there's a lot of, most of the time, you integrate over an odd combination or an odd power, it's going to be zero. So that's why that works out.
But one easy thing for you guys to do is that you can take all these Gaussian integrals, you can just try playing with integrating vectors of that sort or tensors like uk times u of, and see what it can be proportional to. It's just you can think of it as by symmetry argument, or you can just in terms of see there's nothing else that should be proportional to delta kl. That's one way. So this is not trivial, it's obvious at the beginning. I guess that's something I learned. One of the things I learned from this book is that you don't have to take every integral. You can just imagine what it could be. That already restricts a lot the final results. But anyway, so good. So that's
As we found that pi j is faceless, you can write it as factor multiplicated by this minus its trace. We find its trace by this equation. So, what we want is this factor, which is the viscosity. So,
this is what I call eta. Fabry's calling mu, but the same thing.
So a simple way of computing mu is just to compute the pi 1/2 and to find what its relation is with
Okay, is this the final answer?
Yes. In terms of temperature, cross section, and the velocity of particles.
So that's the relative velocity. That also depends on the temperature, doesn't it?
Well, we can find the average velocity in different physical systems.
But that U bar relative, that's the same thermal temperature, isn't it? Or where did you get that U bar relative? Where did that come from?
It's it's U minus U1, the integral of U minus U1
over the thermal, over the Maxwellian distribution.
Yes.
So that also depends on temperature. That because that's a function of the Maxwellian distribution,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's also the function of that temperature. You can. So it's, I mean, you know what it is. It's just a square root of KT divided by M, isn't it? More or less. That's. I think did we derive that? We discussed that last week as well. So these are the same basically, both functions. You can write either one, either temperature in terms of U bar or vice versa. Okay. Did anyone have a simpler derivation? No?
Well, I tried to do it through simple dimensional analysis, but I got something different, so that might be wrong.
So why don't you do that?
Okay. I'll show you what I did, we'll see.
Okay, so we'll do this side. Where's the last thing that vision is? This sounds like a correct derivation. Although you still have made some approximations. So
yeah.
So I guess there could be some missing characters. But it's not by no means it's a straightforward calculation. So I don't blame you. It's complicated. Okay, so what is your approach?
Okay. Well, anyways, for dimensional analysis, start off listing possibly relevant quantities and their dimensions. So we've got viscosity, which I used as, I think that's eta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The same as the mu, okay.
Okay, and just guessing at other ones that might be there, it's the density of the substance. The temperature, and I just skipped a step multiplying to that ultimate constant to get an energy. And finally, molecular cross section. Okay, so figure it out. It's a little vector addition matrix work, and the dimensionless quantity I arrived at was viscosity squared times cross section to the 1/2 over kT rho, which now let's just double check, make sure I didn't make mistakes. This can't be.
You have sigma to the 1/2, so it should be a 1.
Yeah, 1/2, yeah, like 1. And this is 3, so yeah. So dimensionally, this works out. Now, then we just set this to some constant. I usually use K, but I don't want to get mixed up with Boltzmann constant. But yeah, I'll just skip that step anyways. And then we just get the result. It is roughly proportional sigma to this. And I mean, maybe off by, if the dimensional analysis works out, the constant proportionality can still vary a fair bit, so it's a rough estimate.
So comparing, so why would you think Fabro result is different from yours? I mean, just because.
Let's see, I was going to check out my suit just to see if the dimensions and his equation worked out the same way. So let's see.
He has the correct dimension, so.
Yeah, he doesn't rely on density at all.
And instead he has this u-bar relative that you don't have.
Yeah, okay, he has u-bar relative, which depends on, or which is basically kt over m.
The square root of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very good. Root kt over m, so but what's this work here? Cut this out. Okay, over sigma. So then we could, I guess the trick is converting the, I've still got the root kt. M mass of particles would be roughly proportional to rho. So, yeah, I guess it's the conversion of M to density.
Well, the sigma dependencies are very different. So if this is 1 over sigma, yours is 1 over sigma to the power.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the, if what I did is correct, invalidates when we convert M to a density. The density depends on sigma, and we'll get, say, a sigma to the 3/4 on top.
This is very interesting. There is always a problem. The dimension analysis problems often look easier from the hindsight, right? But when you want to do it, there could be problems, and one here is that there could be more parameters that we are
interesting. But, well, the final result here doesn't have anything extra, it has mass instead of density, so it turns into the problem of how the density depends on particle mass and sigma, and, well, obviously, density scales with particle mass times number density of particles, so question, and presumably number density has some dependence on the cross section.
Well, it could be, but it could be that they are independent, right? I guess there could be an upper limit or lower limit, but I mean, in principle, you could have particles of very small cross section of a given density, so you can make cross section large or small.
Yeah, and then you could have a very dispersed.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which, yeah, over cross-sectional matter, yeah. So, if you chose mass instead of density, you would have done.
Yeah, I would have. I just went going through a thought. Density would be more realistic, but I guess actually, in retrospect, maybe mass, since when we start working with the Reynolds number, we use density there anyways.
So you have to have intuition about which.
So that's the problem with dimensional analysis, that it's you never know if you have a good enough intuition unless you know the right answer.
Why are you doing dimension?
So that's the problem. I mean, it does work sometimes, if you want to be generous, you have to add all the parameters that you think should matter. So you would, physically, you would think density does matter, and in the beginning, you couldn't guess it would drop out, and it does drop out here. It's a coincidence in a way that it does drop out, but it does drop out at the end. Okay, so you would, in principle, add mass as well. So that would be another extra parameter, mass of particles.
So then we would end up with a couple different dimensionless quantities, one with
mm-hmm.
one looks like that and one like that. And
exactly. Yeah. So you couldn't exactly say what combination of those, well, what those powers would be if you have more than three.
Well, if we have any more than just one dimensionless quantity, then you can't make much of a guess. You can estimate it in terms of functions, so scaling, but you can't figure out things that you don't get from the full derivation.
So that's kind of that could be a problem with dimensional analysis if you have more than a certain number of parameters. Here there are three parameters, and if you have four, then there is an ambiguity. So perfect, thank you. So let me give you the simple derivation. These are both very, very nice. If this class was like 200 years ago, we would be having lots of papers out of this class. But
bring some of the scientists back then, getting into fistfights.
I often wonder if they were more civilized back then or less civilized.
Remember the stories about Tycho Brahe, so I'm guessing less.
Really? What is this story?
Well, he got into a fight over math. He eventually ended up in a sword fight, and he famously lost his nose in it. So he had a silver nose to replace it.
I see. Okay, so I knew about the silver nose, but I didn't know about where that came from. I see. That's interesting. So the viscosity. So one suggestion that I emailed Mina 2 days ago is just look up the Wikipedia. So they turned out very good answer more and more.
Easier.
Did you do that? Did you look up Wikipedia?
We actually put together.
Okay. Well, the collective wisdom of the people there sometimes helps. But anyway, so what is viscosity? It's I mean, the simple definition you can read in, you probably read in freshman books, freshman physics or a master of physics, the first place you will see it is that if you have a tangential flow, basically, if you have a velocity, if you have a flow in this direction but it's not uniform, the velocity is larger here, say, and it's smaller here, there would be a friction, basically, that these guys want to drag the slower guys ahead, and these guys want to drag the faster guys behind. And the force exerted across this boundary is basically the definition of viscosity. It's eta, this viscosity factor, times the gradient of velocity parallel to the surface, let's say, parallel to the surface. If this gradient is zero, there is no force, there is no friction, that's not hard to imagine. But if there is some gradient, then there would be a force that would drag these guys. And this is times the area, by the way. It's the larger the area. So the force per unit area is constant. Now, it's not hard to see that this is actually... So this is, of course, a regular definition of viscosity. But basically, what this guy is, the definition of the stress tensor, is actually exactly what I'm writing down here. Because the stress tensor is, the definition of the stress tensor is the amount of momentum which passes through unit, exerted on unit area of a surface.
right? So so there are two components, of course. There are two indices. One is the normal to the surface, and the other is the direction of the force. So this is basically area, say, times P 1, 2, let's say. If this is direction x and this is direction y, so P 1, 2 is the force in the x direction, which is except the true surface, this surface, and the normal to this surface is in the y direction. Okay? So, and the statement that Farber wrote up there, this definition, Pij is proportional to mu times lambda ij, is just this. So his mu is my eta, and lambda ij is just a gradient of velocity, which is defined here. And I'm missing factors of two. This is a Rothkamp equation. So that's this is the same definition as Farber had. This is a more intuitive definition. And all I have to do is to see how much momentum is transferred across the surface. Right? Now what's happening here is that you have some exponent distribution here, molecules moving in all directions here. And it's the same here, more or less. Molecules going in all directions here. The mean velocity is power larger here than it is here. So some of these molecules have found their way, because there are random exponent velocities, so some of them have found their way across the surface to the other side. But since these guys have a larger mean velocity, larger mean velocity, the ones that make it across the surface are generally moving faster than the guys that are already here. And the same is true the other way around. Since these guys are moving slower than these guys, the ones that make it across the surface will be generally slower than all the other guys, the rest of the guys that are here. So that's a way of transferring momentum from one side to the other. So F, which is the force, is the rate of transferring momentum from one side to the other. So it's the area times the rate of the particles that cross the surface. So that's N times V bar, let's say, or just call it U relative. That's the same U relative as Farber had. So this is the thermal velocity, random velocity of particles across the surface. So this is the number of particles that they cross the surface per unit time. The momentum that they transfer, each of them, is mass times grad V times lambda. Now, what is this? So I need to put in the momentum here. But of course, the farther away the particles are coming from, the larger is their momentum difference or the velocity difference from where they're ending up. Now, lambda is a typical mean free path, basically. So it's similar to what the tau that Farber had. So lambda is 1 over n sigma. This is a mean free path. So how far do the molecule go until it collides with another molecule? So that's more or less what's happening, that this molecule has those molecules here have some mean velocity, and the ones that wander off in this direction go a distance of lambda before they are scattered by these other molecules, and essentially inject their momentum that they have from here into here, and vice versa. And this lambda is similar to the tau Farber had. So tau is 1 over n sigma v, or u relative. lambda is just one over n sigma. So this is mean free path. This is the distance tau over time. Now, I'm looking at it in terms of lambda. So gravity times lambda is the velocity difference across the mean free path times n, that's momentum. Right? And this is equal to a times beta times gravity. So let's see, am I missing something? So this is nu, this is just the number of particles that pass. And this is the momentum that they carry, each particle. So this is the total rate of momentum transfer. So the eta that you get then is, using this definition, I divide out A and grad B. So the eta is just m u relative times lambda, which is 1 over n sigma. So let's see, I want to compare it to what we had up there. So n's cancel. And u relative is just a terminal velocity. That's what Brian substituted up there. U relative is just a square root of kt over n. N is the mass of particle. So this is just s square root of ktn divided by sigma. So that's this. This is a rough derivation of that formula. And so this is a cool attitude. But Faber derived. Of course, that's the numerical factor, so this is an order of magnitude. Okay, good. So now we have three derivations for formula. So this is only the first part of the problem. So Faber, do you want to finish the rest of it? So by the way, did anybody have any question about this? No? Perfect.
I don't think I would have thought of that. This, it's good, yeah. It's just, I understand it after I see it. Personally, I don't think I would have thought of it.
Well, that's why it's just a Wikipedia.
It didn't look much, actually.
It didn't? Well, this is in Wikipedia, but...
Is derivations in Wikipedia? Or just this?
More or less. I mean, maybe just explanation. But the formula is there. And yeah. Okay.
No.
Yeah, you can write something.
So you should find the Reynolds number, which is L.
Is V the same as mu bar, or is it different?
I've taken the same number before.
We
have done the right thing.
Not really. But sometimes they might be comparable, but often, but they don't have to.
So I guess my numbers are not.
Well, they might not be off too much because the velocities aren't really that different in nature. So. but yeah, there is a difference. So u bar relative is a thermal velocity. It's just the internal motion, as you've seen through this derivation. The capital V is the typical velocity of a system that you're looking at. So that could be, depending on the system, depending on the situation you have, you could have a river or you could have a water pipe. And they both have the same viscosity. It's the same water
flow through them, so they have the same viscosity, but capital V could be very different because the velocity is very different. So, but that's fine.
Isn't the total velocity of the flow like proportional to the individual velocities of the particles?
Not necessarily.
Because UREL is compared to, it's defined as being compared to the average velocity.
Like it's the average velocity of the particles, and that's what's flowing as the average total. Right?
Well, UREL is the average speed, average speed of particles relative to the average velocity.
Okay.
Which is, it's like it's velocity dispersion. That makes more sense.
Yeah, it is velocity dispersion. So, I mean, for example, in this room, like molecules have some velocity with respect to the threshold, some mean velocity. So some have some random velocity, but the mean velocity is zero in this room. And that's the capital V that I'm interested. So that's the mean velocity. So it's exactly mean velocity with respect to the velocity dispersion. That's the conference. Okay. So those are your answers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's see, they don't quite match with mine.
That's because of that mistake, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Amazon River. So how did you... So what is the U relative, U R relative for Amazon?
I'm going 20 kilometers per second.
20 kilometers per second, so that's what...
And the river flowing at that rate.
That's very fast for a river, I guess. Sorry, what's the river?
Very violent.
Yeah, I don't think it could be that violent, but that's how fast Earth is moving around. So.
So we can retrograde
the size. Yeah. So I doubt that that's even actually stay bound to the Earth. It would probably flow into space as because what is the escape velocity from Earth? I think it's
60 kilometers.
Okay, so it's gonna be really violent. But okay, so and what did you take for L for the size of
11,000 meters.
11,000 meters. Good. So I guess we did look at Wikipedia.
I actually estimated that length scale by width, not length of the river.
By width.
Yeah.
I mean,
width.
What is width? How did you get to it?
It's 11,000 meters.
Mm. That's
okay.
Same. Yeah.
Sorry, but
it's just the width. Yeah, it's the width.
Yeah, it's the bit. I mean, it should be the bit. Yes, the length is very long.
Yeah,
it's
well, no, I was thinking, I thought you said kilometers for.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's 11 kilometers.
I still think it's long.
Apparently, is the widest it gets. So, to see, what other astrophysics course you learn about the width of the Amazon River? So, it's 11 kilometers. But, so I guess that might be just the only difference, right? It's. So you take this 20 kilometers per second. So the velocity that I assumed was something like...
I guess you used temperature here instead of the relative velocity, so...
But it's... how did you get that relative velocity?
I just researched last night. For the typical particle velocity of, for instance, water.
Uh-huh. Is it, it's 20 kilometers per second. So can you estimate that somehow from using temperature and other things that you know about the water? Maybe you had that formula that is the square root of kT over m.
What was k?
So kT is the temperature, it was energy times temperature. So there are a few things that would be helpful throughout this course. So, one is that a Kelvin is 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. Okay, so let's put that in. So
Kelvin? And you're saying electron volts, so for KT, okay?
Yes, a Kelvin is 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. So KT would be, so for 100 Kelvin, it would be 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Okay, yes. Electron volts, so just write electron volts as well. And the mass is the mass of protons. So what is the mass of protons in electron volts? Well, so we know mass of electron is 511 keV, so it's almost an MeV, right? The mass of proton is 2,000 times larger, so it's basically a GeV, right? So we can just divide that by a GeV. Okay. So what is it now? 10 to the minus 5 more or less, right?
10 to the 5. Or minus to the minus 5. Oh.
I think it's 10 to the minus 5, isn't it? Right? Because GeV is 10 to the 9. So that's 10 to the minus 11 divided by 2 is 10 to the minus 5.5. Okay, so that this is in units of. So this is in natural units. So this is in units of the speed of light. Now that's so that's the units that usually cosmologists use. So the natural units, you have only C is 1, H bar is 1. You only have an energy unit. You can describe it in any unit. You people usually describe it in electron volts. So velocities are dimensionless. So whenever you get a velocity, it's in units of the speed of light. So here, a square root of kT over m. If you use it, if you write it down in natural units, so mass is, but basically mass of electron, mass of proton is 1 GeV divided by CS squared. That's how it's speed up, right?
Again, 900 meters per second.
900 meters per second. That's 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 5.5.
I got, well, about 3 times 10 to the negative 6 on the speed of light.
Okay.
It's not
okay,
to the calculator.
Okay, so that's 900 meters per second, did you say?
Yeah.
That's a kilometer per second, right? So you were saying 20 kilometers per second. So that's much faster. No.
What's the significance?
And what was your answer for the Reynolds number?
I got 10 to the 10.
So that would just defer one order of magnitude.
Yours is 27.
No, if we could use this, it would just be 26, 10 to the 26. No, 10 to the 28.
No. No, but this is just. Wait a minute.
I mean, if we change U, it would just.
Okay, what about the other values?
I should use a
smaller value for capital V. Because capital V, instead of that, or instead of 20 kilometers per second, I use, I think, 100 centimeters or 1 meter per second, which is the speed of Amazon.
Yeah, well, what cross-sectional area did you use?
Still cross-sectional area of molecules, I guess.
Which is
to the -9.
10 to the -9
centimeters. So the cubic centimeter square.
Is that the cross section?
I found this.
Really? I would think it would be a square of that. Really? because the molecule is, I don't know.
The rough end estimate was on like around 10 to the -20, which I just got angstrom squared, but probably larger than that for molecules. I searched on the net and couldn't find anything. So
for the cross section molecules,
yeah.
Well, I actually looked up the viscosity of water. That's what they do.
Well, yeah, I found that.
I wonder how that matches with this rough estimate. So viscosity of water that I found was in CGS units 10 to the minus 2. So if you just plug in this formula that we have, we can get the cross section, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's 10 to the minus 2 is eta, and we have to get the units right. That's kind of tough. any event, so we have some differences. So let's see. So sigma, you did you use 10^-9 for sigma? That sounds too big. That sounds too big, right? Because that means that you're 10^-9 centimeters squared. So that means your molecules are basically 10^-4 centimeters in size, right? Is that?
Why do you say that?
Hmm?
Why do you say that?
It's just a square root of 10^-9.
I think we didn't square the diameter of the molecule. We just assume sigma is the same as the diameter of the molecule.
Okay.
That's still the mistake.
I actually get, when I put the viscosity of water into that formula,
uh-huh.
I get a cross-section of pretty close to 10^-20.
Uh-huh.
Square, or, yeah. 8 times 10^-21, so rounding off.
I see. Okay. So that might be that. Okay, so that's another factor. 10 orders of magnitude, more or less. Oh, okay, it's less than. Yes, 9 orders of magnitude. So that could be the reason. So you have, I think it's 7 or 8 orders of magnitude from velocity. And 7 or 8 orders of magnitude from cross section, and if including the ones which will drag this down probably to 10^10 more or less, right? Makes sense. What did you take for the temperature?
Ten degrees centigrade.
10 degrees? You're in Kelvin.
No.
Yeah, whenever working with temperature, you have to convert to kelvins.
Did you put in Kelvin or 10?
No, Kelvin.
Oh, you put Kelvin. Okay, yes. So what is it in Kelvin? It's
283.
Okay, you put
283 Kelvin.
Okay, so that temperature is fine then, I guess. So it's just a cross-section. Okay, so that's good. That's fine. How about the sound?
Temperature 5,000 kelvins.
Okay.
Length scale 10^6. Kilometers.
6 kilometers. Good.
Density 1.4 grams per cubic centimeter.
Is that reasonable?
About the density of water.
Yeah, I've heard that. Huh. That's true, isn't it? I had it somewhere. 24. Yeah, that's true. It's a gram per cube. Okay, good, good. And the velocity? Oh, you just used the thermal velocity, right?
No, I used
618 kilometers per second. That's escape velocity from the sun, which is more or less the same as thermal velocity. No, wait a minute. No, that is a problem. So the temperature that you're using is much lower than the thermal, has much lower velocity than the velocity that you're using. So okay, that could be a problem, but I think you get in the right order of magnitude for this, more or less, for five. Yes. So the velocity for 5,000 Kelvin. So 5,000 Kelvin is more or less an electron volt. And again, doing this exercise, you get in units of the speed of light. Am I doing this right? So you get something like 10^-4 in units of speed of light, 4 or 5. So that's 10^5. Centimeter per second, that's a kilometer per second, more or less. So it's a lower temperature than. So basically, the fact that the surface of the sun is much colder than its inside. So the escape velocity is much larger. So the mean temperature between the sun is much larger than the temperature itself.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so that's fine. I mean, these are, I didn't really tell you exactly how to do this, so that's fine. So that's a large number, compared to the 35. And, okay, so how are the activation disks?
The speed of sound, length scale 10,000 light years.
So what is the speed of sound?
10 to the 5 meters per second. And 10,000 light years, and the density 10 to the 9 gram per cubic centimeters.
So when did how did you get these numbers?
The speed of sound.
Either of them, the speed of sound, how did you get them?
Just looking at the
Okay. So the velocity you said is 10 to the 5 centimeters per second.
Meters per second.
Meters per second. So 10 to the 8, 10 to the 7 centimeters per second. So that's like a thousandth of the speed of light. Okay, good. And the size, is it 10,000 AU?
10,000 light years.
10,000 light years? Where did you get that from?
I just guessed actually.
We did it for Mina, and we did everything from the net, just.
That
10,000 light years is the size of the galaxy.
No, 100,000 light years is the size of Milky Way, for example. So I said 10,000, you know, 1,000 can be.
Okay.
I didn't think about it.
But it's too big.
It's too big, I think.
Especially for that velocity. No, I guess the velocity is fine. So the velocity is 10 to the 5 meters per second, so that's like 100 kilometers. So that's I guess that's typical velocity.
Yeah, my offhand guess would be like 100 AU or something, size of the our solar system to size of an acreage. Yeah. But
yeah.
It'd probably be bigger with the quasar. Those are mostly black holes, so yeah.
But not as the size of the Milky Way.
So it is a tricky question because. I'm guilty because of writing it down the way accretion disk is big, so it does extend. Accretion disks do extend, can extend a lot. They don't extend as much as 1,000 light years. 100 AU is where you can see the absorption line, where you can see the emission lines from accretion disk in quasars. So it's 100 AU more or less. And I think the temperature is slightly is hotter than, or the velocity is not higher than what you're assuming. Maybe 10,000 kilometers per second. But then it does extend outward. So I guess you could go farther out. Not quite as much as that. So for example, for our Milky Way, Milky Way is under quasar, so maybe it's not this thing. We don't really know how far that creation is going, but okay. So I would have guessed more like 100 AU rather than 10,000 light years. So the difference is how big is a light year? How many light years is an AU?
Well, I think things more in terms of parsecs. So. I mean, well, parsec is about 3 light years, but 1,000 light years is order of a megaparsec, which is the size of a small group of galaxies.
Mm-hmm. And how does that compare to an AU?
It's a factor of 5.
It cannot be a factor. Only 5 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, 5 orders of magnitude.
Okay, that's what I mean. So it's, an AU is 10 to the 13th centimeter. So, by the way, at the back of Padmanabhan's book, you can find all these numbers if you have it. So, an AU is. Where is it? I think it is here. But a megaparsec is 10 to the 24 centimeter. So, the parsec is 10 to the 18 centimeter. Okay, so I guess it doesn't have an AU for some reason. AU is, I think, 10 to the 13th centimeters. So I guess it only has cosmology numbers for some reason. Sorry, guys.
So it's five orders of magnitude as Nathan was pointing at. And so 10, so I guess it's just six or seven orders of magnitude difference. Okay, so that's just, okay, that's fine. So
that's one magnitude between terms.
Yes.
Seven.
Yeah, I mean, especially given that these general numbers are big. So what else? So I guess that's all you needed, right? More or less.
An intergalactic medium.
Hmm?
An intergalactic medium.
Okay, so how about that? What do you do?
45 megaparsecs. Speed, again, the same.
Okay.
And density, 10 to the minus 3 grams per cubic centimeter.
That's too big, isn't it? So what is the density of intergalactic medium?
Like one atom per cubic meter?
Yeah.
Whatever that translates to?
So what is it in grams per? So it's every atom is like 10 to the minus 24 grams. Right? So this is like 10 to the minus 24 gram per cubic meter, which is something like 10 to the minus 30, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So your density is much higher, actually, than... And the velocity, you said you assume the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something else we needed. Temperature.
10 to the 6 Kelvin.
10 to the 6 Kelvin, so that's reasonable.
Hmm. Hold on a sec, for temperature 10 to the 6, I would have done like 2 Kelvins of cosmic microwave background.
Now, it turns out that the intergalactic medium is very hot because it's ionized by, I think by the quasar light.
Hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So the ionization, so the temperature is around an electron volt. It's mostly 10 to the 4 Kelvin, most of the intergalactic medium. Because that's, so if you say the stars are emitting at the same temperature as the sun, okay, so there are stars and there are quasars. Quasars, I cannot give you an argument, but I think they are comparable. So for a star, the temperature, say, is 6,000 Kelvin. So it's around an electron volt. So if you ionize something, then their energy would be of order of an electron volt, which is around 10 to the 4 Kelvin. I mean, that's a very rough argument. But if you don't have enough energy, don't ionize it. But if you have enough energy, the energy at least maximum will be around an electron volt, which is 10 to the 4 Kelvin. Now, that's the minimum, but it does get higher if you get closer to the clusters. And it basically, more or less by definition, clusters have temperature between the keV and the 10 keV, which is, as I said, electron volt is 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So keV is from 10 to the 7 Kelvin to 10 to the 8 Kelvin. So that temperature is slightly higher. Now the size that you took, how do you get that 45 megaparsecs?
It's the size of the galaxy cluster, I assume.
45 megaparsecs?
Something like that.
But I think that's a bit too big. I think a megaparsec is more like the size of a... I guess that's what I was saying.
A decent group is a megaparsec in diameter.
So a cluster is a slightly bigger, I guess. That depends.
Yeah, cluster is 5, maybe... 10 megaparsecs, super clusters or groups of clusters, again, another order of magnitude.
Yeah. So I guess, for something big, if something is big enough, you can get that much. Now, I guess that what I had in mind was something more of the size of a cluster, and for that, the Reynolds number is significantly smaller as, I think, the main problem is the density then, because you have much larger density. And, because if you have a large density, you get a large Reynolds number, and that we get. That's 30 orders of magnitude already. And what did you get for the cross? What did you assume for the cross section?
I think I assumed 10 to the minus 9 again. Yeah.
10 to the minus 9. Okay, so that gets down. So that's probably too big, right? And the cross section, sorry, too. That's too big, right? We decided it's more like 10 to the minus 20. So that would increase the radius number, I think. So you're, because you have a larger number in the denominator. If you put a smaller number, you get something bigger. Okay, so I guess we might be off 10, 20 orders of magnitude in all of this, but the main idea that these are all very large numbers, and that's that was the main point of this exercise. So let me just remind you a couple of things before we are done with this, and I guess this is going to conclude our first session for me. I suspect that we're going to spend next week on the same problem set, so I'm guessing you're not going to have new problem sets for next week, so you're going to spend time, hopefully, still working, finishing. How many of you get back to finish this? No, nobody. Okay. That's what I suspected. So you have more time. Hopefully, the next week, you get to go through this. So what I wanted to say was that if you just look at this formula that we had, eta is mu relative divided by sigma. The Reynolds number, and the definition is here, L, V, rho, divided by eta, which is L, V, rho, divided by m, and u relative, divided by sigma. Am I missing something? That would be around divided by. I must be missing something here.
One in terms of temperature?
Eta is U bar and this is correct. Okay. Somehow I didn't want this row to be here. So I guess it is there.
So maybe you wrote the kinematic viscosity instead of the normal viscosity.
No, okay, sorry, I remember what I was saying. So I wanted to write it in terms of the mean free path. So this is rho divided by m is just mean number density. Okay. And if you remember from here, lambda was 1 over n sigma. So I can just replace this by lambda in the denominator. So this is L times V divided by lambda and U relative. So this is basically a dimensionless expression. Well, this is a simple expression to think about intuitively for the Reynolds number. So there are two ratios that essentially appear here. One is the size of the system divided by the mean free path, and another is the velocity across the system divided by the mean motion of the system. So, if either of these are big, either of these ratios are big, that means that Reynolds number becomes big. And if you remember, I'm not sure how much we discussed this last week. Basically, if this is big, that means viscosity is irrelevant. Right, is small because it's one over viscosity. So the bigger R is the smaller is the viscosity. This the less relevant is viscosity. And this is really the only dimensionless quantity that you can get in fluid equations. that describes the relative importance of viscosity to not viscous spin. But basically you did, I'm not sure if we actually got to do this, that you compare the regular term that enters in your Euler equation. This is like minus graph V divided by rho plus eta Laplacian of V. And if you assume that this is like over the V squared divided by L, and this is V divided by L squared, relative importance of this term to this term, or let's put it out, the relative importance of this term to this term is just this R, right? If you just say this is V squared divided by L, and this is eta times V divided by L squared, and divide this by this, this is what you get. So this will tell you there are two ways to make viscosity irrelevant, I guess, or otherwise important. If you get your system, you make your system big, compare in units of the mean free path. So basically, particles cannot have scattered a lot of times before they can cross the box. That's this ratio. And it's easy to see what's happening. You have one there, two special gradients here, one special gradient here. So the bigger your system is, the smaller become the special gradients, typically, if you have a smooth flow. That means that the viscosity is less relevant. And that's basically the reason why in astrophysics, and even on Earth, viscosity is so irrelevant, because everything is very weak. And mean free path is small. So, yes?
So for this L over lambda factor, is it sort of saying that there isn't a velocity gradient because your transport between scattering is very effective, very efficient, so that momentum is...
That's right. That's absolutely right. That's what it means. So if you're saying velocity is coherent on larger scales, if velocity gradient is small. So basically, velocity is coherent over one mean free path. That means there is no momentum transport from one point to the other because everything is moving with the same velocity. And here, if velocity is much larger than the thermal velocity, that this also means that this term is relatively more important than this because this is quadratic in B, this is linear in B. And this basically happens when you have turbulence. Places where the velocity becomes large, and this term essentially dominates over this term. If the places where you don't have turbulence, basically velocity becomes very better. For whatever reason, this term dominates, velocity is small. And there are different intuitive ways of thinking about this, but it's basically there are two ways of making viscosity important. Either you have to look at very slow motions, and for example, you have a very slow motion, viscosity becomes important. That's the RPV becomes one. Or you make the mean free path big, then also viscosity becomes important. Now there is some subtlety in these two factors, especially in intergalactic medium, because cross section isn't very, very well defined actually, because you have ionized medium, and there. You have to actually look at long range of scattering. You have electrons and protons, and they have Coulomb forces in between them. So I haven't really, if you want to do this properly, you have to actually look at these long range of scatterings. And you don't have a fixed cross section. Your cross section depends on the thermal velocity itself, because electron and protons that pass through each other very fast, they don't scatter basically off each other. The ones that are going slower, they see each other at a longer distance. Away. So it's kind of like the gravitational problem that Mark did for you the first day, and you did, that there is no fixed cross section, depends on how fast you go. But at the end of the day, it turns out that it's a big number. But one of the things that happened here is that lambda actually gets, it turns out that lambda gets tangent big. So this is really the only place that I think this number could be really off, because you have an ionized medium. And lambda actually does get big in clusters, inside clusters, not outside clusters, but in the inner regions of clusters in particular. this viscosity might become important. Although this is a controversial issue. So it's something that people argue about. And for example, Brian McNamara at the physics department, he wrote, so there are these centers of clusters, the so-called cooling flows, where people don't quite understand what's going on. And then one other thing that could be going on is there is viscosity or thermal conduction. You see, it turns out actually they appear in the same places because you have very high gradient of temperature, gradient of velocity. They appear more or less the same way. So there could be in central regions of clusters that viscosity or thermal conduction, that they are really very similar processes, play some role. But it's a controversial issue. And for example, Brian McNamara doesn't believe that, but there are some people, other people who think that's what's happening in central regions. That's why we don't understand exactly what's going on. But anyway, it's an interesting thing to look at, and we're gonna look at, for the rest of the problems, I guess you're gonna spend more time understanding what happens in these situations where R is very large, the viscosity is not important, and actually, we have another session. We're breaking up now, but we have another session. So we might actually have to solve problem two for me, right? Okay.